It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the author of a new book on segregation in American cities tells us how decades of government decisions created unequal spaces and why they've lasted for so long. First, when he took office, President Biden ordered government agencies to identify the greatest threats climate change posed to them and to come up with plans to deal with those threats. The Obama administration had done something similar. That work mostly stopped under the Trump administration. Now, 23 government agencies, including defense, homeland security, education, and justice, have released climate change adaptation plans. We're talking now about climate change and how government agencies plan on changing their work to adapt to it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think are some of the greatest threats posed by climate change? Has it affected you, your community, in some way? Do you worry about it affecting you in the future? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Jesse Keenan is an associate professor of real estate in the School of Architecture at Tulane University. He researches climate change adaptation in human environments like towns and cities. Jesse, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
So we have these 23 agencies talking about climate change. Some you'd think about, you know, oh, energy, agriculture, that makes sense with climate change. Others, justice, homeland security, veterans affairs. Why this across-the-board look at climate change, do you think, from all these different agencies?
Well, listen, we all rely on the federal government in ways we don't even think about or appreciate, whether it's getting our ticket scanned at the airport or driving down the road, getting debris clearance off the road, or going to the grocery store and thinking about food safety for the meat we buy for dinner. There's so many things that we do that are an outcome of the contribution of public service in this country at federal, state, and local governments. And for the federal government, there really isn't anything that they do or will do or could do that isn't going to be impacted or is already being impacted by climate change. And some part of that is business continuity and getting people to the office to do their jobs, if you will. And some of it is really rethinking their mission. What are the new missions? What are the new challenges that are going to rise that will require some action or engagement with?
In your own work, I know you look at sometimes subtle effects of climate change, the things we might not obviously think about, but that can come and bite us down the road. Why is it important to look at some of those maybe second and third level effects of a changing climate?
Yeah, I think we all have different vulnerabilities, and different communities have higher or lower levels of vulnerability depending on what context and where you are in the country. And by the way, I think the state of Wisconsin in many ways could be a beneficiary indirectly of some of these secondary impacts, particularly with a more moderate climate, not as cold as you think, perhaps in Wisconsin, for if you live in Louisiana or you're escaping hurricanes, Louisiana. But to your question, it's important to understand that, you know, understand climate change within the context of global change, right? A broader set of issues relating to aging society, changing technology, growing inequality, limitations in our mobility, whether that's class, job, labor mobility, whatever that may be. All of those things are stressors. And we tend to look at climate change through a series of shocks, you know, storm here, flood there. But in reality, and those are important, we don't want to overlook that, but there's also a lot of stresses. And it's the stresses for the average American household or small business owner, what have you, that really add up, right? You know, the insurance going up, the cost of food going up, the cost of health going up, all of these things which have some attribution or cause and effect or causality, let's say, associated with climate change impacts, they burden us, and there are additional cost burdens, which in a country of growing inequality or economic inequality, among other things, that's a huge challenge. And so I think we begin to think about how we address these challenges, not just in mitigating the hazards and the risks, but how can we make efforts to address all of these other allied goals that we have for ourselves as a society and as a set of communities. How can we think about affordability and housing and reducing our costs and greater access to healthcare? Well, all of these things are caught up directly or indirectly with climate in one form or fashion.
Talking to Jesse Keenan from Tulane University about climate change, how we can prepare for it, adapt to it after A number of government agencies did a review and released their threat assessments, their plans to adapt to climate change. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Jesse, we won't hit all 23 agencies. I do want to take a peek at a few of them, though. You've mentioned a couple times our food supply. Its reliability, our food costs, and the Department of Agriculture, the USDA, took a look at climate change and how it could impact that. What kind of things did they have in mind that struck you?
Well, listen, agriculture, the food supply, the labor force that supports that's critical for all across the country, but particularly in an ag state like Wisconsin. There's a number of different challenges we have. You can think about reduced soil quality. We have greater extreme precipitation events, for instance, which wash away some of our topsoil or challenge the stability of that. We have greater likelihood of extreme precipitation and convection storm events that create hail that damage our crops. We have pests and diseases that are coming with new ranges that are moving up in the area that formerly tropical diseases that are now moving further and further north. We even have challenges to pollinators, right? We rely on bees and all kinds of other pollinators to pollinate our crops. Well, even they are challenged by this shifting pests, diseases, and blight that comes along with a changing environment and a changing ecology. But we also have challenges of getting our food and our commodities to the market or to processing. A number of years ago, we had very low levels in the Mississippi River, and barge traffic couldn't get downriver to get to the market and to get to processing. We've had damage. We've had a number of different extreme events which damaged our capacity for storage of particularly of grains. You can go throughout the supply chain from ag to food production, supply distribution, and the like. And at every stage, there are challenges ahead of us. And some of those challenges are adapting to climate impacts, but also transition risks, right? And I know in a big dairy state like Wisconsin, thinking about methane and thinking about changing consumer appetites for dairy products, by thinking about, you know, carbon neutrality and things like that, that's a risk as well. And how do we transition to new forms of processing that can keep that industry alive? So there's a lot of different risks, both physical risks and transition risks.
Another factor, energy and our energy supply. You have done some work on an interesting thing. Okay, so we've had a climate change caused flood. Well, my house is okay, but you've written in the past, if my power plant was flooded out, or if a power plant has stayed over that I count on to supply energy, I'm maybe not okay. Can you talk about that kind of threat?
Well, you know, power and energy, electricity, this is one dimension of multiple critical infrastructure services that we rely on. And we tend to think about, you know, are we at risk in our neighborhood? You know, what can we do more locally without really recognizing that we have a lot of critical infrastructure dependencies that can really, in some cases, extend hundreds of miles away from where we live. So when we begin to, and all of these federal agencies begin to do their vulnerability assessments and understand the manifestations of physical climate impacts, it isn't just about pulling up an address and looking at this address. And by the way, that is important. And it's really important, as was noted by the Social Security Administration, for getting people to work and getting checks cut to people who rely on Social Security. But for everything else, and for those of us that require on energy and water, the mail service, you know, so many things that relate to critical infrastructure services, it makes the challenge much more complex. And it makes it much more of a regional and national scale problem. And again, this is where the federal government and federal leadership has the opportunity to take over. And I do want to say that this isn't just an opportunity. This isn't really just about managing risk. There's a lot of opportunities that come along with adapting to climate change that create new products and new services that are good for our economy and good for our labor force. You know, I hear President Biden talk about, you know, good jobs. And, you know, I think for a lot of people, and even myself, it just sounds like incessant political pandering. But the reality is, and I wish you'd be a little bit more articulate about this, because the reality is there is a lot of economic opportunity. We're already seeing it. I'm sure we've already seen it to some dimension in Wisconsin with new products and services that are driven by demand. people around the world, institutional investors, consumers are changing their preferences. They want to make positive investments that are truly sustainable and have accounted for climate risk in their investments. So I think, you know, a lot of what we're looking at here from the federal government is an opportunity to develop these new value add jobs and services. And the U.S. Department of Defense in their climate adaptation plan really hit home this point. I mean, the Department of Defense is has an enormous supply chain for producing all kinds of stuff, and they have a huge capacity for research and development. So as they begin to mobilize their capacity for new ideas, new intellectual property, new products, new services, that's really, I think, going to be very catalytic and a huge opportunity for American growth in a sustainable way.
Talking to Jesse Keenan from Tulane University, Associate Professor of Real Estate, and also studies climate change and its impact. He's talking to us about plans released by 23 government agencies last week to increase climate change resilience. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What steps should be taken, do you think, on small scales, on large scales, to adapt and become more resilient to a changing climate? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Jesse Keenan, Associate Professor of Real Estate at Tulane University, who studies climate change adaptation. We're looking at federal government plans to become more resilient to threats posed by global warming. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. 1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Mark is with us in Richland Center. Mark, hi.
Hello. The real estate world that we have for the built infrastructure in most of our cities is a lot of bricks and mortar. And the energy footprint of cities is mostly in the heating and cooling of buildings. So if we took the existing infrastructure thinking we're going to demolish it and build more efficient buildings, would be a waste of the energy potential that those buildings have if we would simply encase those buildings in a secondary envelope and then let that bricks and mortar become an energy flywheel. You could see these buildings reduce their energy footprint by as much as 50%. And it doesn't take much to put a secondary envelope around a building and then bump the window cavities out by another, say, 6 inches or 10 inches. And you could then reduce the energy footprint on the biggest consumer of energy, which is heating and cooling and buildings. Secondarily, this whole question of the Department of Defense, we're going at war all around the world with bases all over the world to take resources mostly related to energy when we could be putting that money into energy efficiency here. So it makes little sense to ask the Department of Defense to become more efficient at what they do when we're basically wasting that money going to war to take resources that we wouldn't otherwise need.
Mark, thanks for the call. A lot to talk about there. Jesse, first of all, he had some specific ideas on retrofitting existing buildings as part of our climate change efforts. So what do you think?
Yeah, listen, I think the caller has some great points that hopefully the listeners appreciate. And, you know, approximately 40% of our carbon emissions really are in the built environment, and they largely do come from the energy associated with heating and cooling and electrification and the like. Now, there is a challenge. We can't so easily just have an additional skin or layer on the building for purposes of reducing emissivity or the release of heat and the exchange of heat, hot and cold temperatures and things like that. It's not so easy. A lot of buildings have the structural capacity. It's also expensive. There's a lot of people out there who can barely pay rent and barely pay their mortgage who simply wouldn't have the capacity. But that being said, building retrofits is our single greatest opportunity. And I think the caller's really, it's not so easy as the caller suggests, but I think that there's many different things that you can do in terms of building retrofits that really, and a lot of it's just windows and doors and simple things you can do for weatherization and your attic and the like that are indeed expensive, but do add up. And I think we'll have new financing programs, new building regulations. And ultimately in a city like New York City, there's carbon tax that's already on the books that's relating to buildings. Now, when it comes to DOD, yes, we do have a lot of facilities around the world for geostrategic reasons. You know, DOD is in a huge, and you know, I appreciate the critique associated with just, you know, walking away from bases and things like that. But yeah, you know, with the exception of the Iraq and Afghanistan, for the most part, the DoD has actually done a lot, for instance, with energy resilience. Our largest single origin of casualties, that is the largest amount of casualties of people killed and injured during our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, came from guarding fuel convoys. And so the Department of Defense, it was like more than 50%. I forget the exact number. It's a very large percentage. And the Department of Defense started to think about how can we develop more energy resilience in our grid system and in our base development and things like that. That has already, that technology, those innovations have already begun translated and domesticated here in the United States. So there's a lot of indirect and direct investments that come out of these things, and it's hard to know. But the DoD does an awful lot beyond just base and facilities infrastructure.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Nick on the line in La Crosse. Nick, hi.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like your guest to talk a little bit about the amount of waste heat that is lost in the United States creating energy. According to the National Renewable Energy Lab, we lose close to 2/3 of all the energy that is produced just as heat. And if we could capture, you know, a significant portion of that heat that we're already losing, that we're already creating, we should be able to create a tremendous amount of heating, cooling, and energy out of that. And another thing, if we could approve third-party financing for municipalities to put up energy production systems, we could actually reduce our taxes.
Nick, so, thanks.
Just a couple of points.
Gotcha, Nick. Thanks for the call. Jesse, is there opportunity in wasted heat, especially in the energy production process?
Listen, your callers really should be on the faculty of many universities. The loss of heat indeed is an enormous challenge, and we have it's also an enormous opportunity in technological terms. We have very sophisticated what we call cogeneration plants that capture that heat, compress the heat, and recycle it within the generation of electricity for buildings and various smaller scale infrastructure applications. And that cogen heat is driven by turbines that are and other equipment that's extremely expensive, has huge ongoing maintenance costs and warranties. It makes sense. It can actually reduce the base load of a big skyscraper, for instance, by about 30 or 40%. That is the kind of base amount of electricity that any given building will consume. It's hard to get this stuff to scale up. And certainly in Finland and other countries, we've had district level heating, but that requires a certain intensity and density of urban development. But I do think what the caller's getting at is quite critical, which is that there's opportunities here for technological advancement to bring this stuff and scale it down to homes, scale it down to water heaters, right? This isn't just about electrical generation. It has a lot to do with water heat, heating water as well. So there's a lot of opportunities to translate this into consumer level gadgets, tools, and widgets that can capture that and lead to cogeneration. When it comes to third-party financing, there is a lot out there in terms of accessible public finance for municipal-owned utilities and public utilities to engage in an awful lot, from grid resilience, smart grids, generation, renewable. I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff out there, and it's a fair amount of sophistication. And by the way, there's a ton of money in the private sector globally that wants to invest in this stuff, and we have a relatively positive tax structure to support that here in the United States. I think there's things that we can do. There's always opportunities to be had, but indeed, at the end of the day, these kinds of investments, as the caller highlighted, can actually reduce our tax bill. At the end of the day, not just our utility bill, can reduce our tax bill. 10% of the bill, of all the bills in Miami-Dade County in Florida, are just the energy costs of pumping and moving water around. So it's critically important that we understand where these benefits are. And it's critically important that as a country, we make these investments in technology.
Nick, thanks a lot for that call. Jesse, a lot of the agency's plans focus on the unequal nature of climate change impacts, how they affect poor communities, marginalized communities, both within maybe a city and around the globe. Can you share your thoughts on that a little bit?
I think what we understand is that the costs and the benefits of climate mitigation, that is reducing greenhouse gases as well as climate adaptation, how we respond and prepare for climate impacts, are unevenly distributed. And there's a challenge in terms of procedural justice. That is, who gets to participate and who gets to help set the rules and how things get resourced and distributed is also challenged. So we can hope that we can use our democratic processes to decide where to invest, where to disinvest, and to think about those who get left behind. But certainly for both climate mitigation and adaptation, adaptation to one person may be maladaptation to another. And then we have to worry about who gets left behind. We have to think about the efficiency, the effectiveness, and also ultimately the fairness of the investments that we make as a country and as public stewards of our common resources. So it's a huge methodological challenge, and there's lots of advances in measurement science and also in law and policy that I think are helping us get there. But the first step is just acknowledging that there's a great deal of inequality and there's a great deal of inequity that exists in our institutions. But at the same time, we have to come together to work together to recognize that we're all in, as our peoples might have come to this country in different ships, but we're all in the same boat now as a tremendous civil rights leader who recently passed away used to say. And I think we have to understand our collective responsibility to each other. And climate change is one of those things where we're all going to have to work together. And understanding those vulnerabilities is the first step.
And Jesse, just in our last few moments, we have these reports from federal agencies. Are these just ballast for the archives of the future, or do you see these as, you know, something that's going to create change?
These are actually, for most of the agencies, these are reflections of ongoing work that has been part of their mission and for some time, independent of whatever presidential administration we have. NASA in particular, which has a lot of really advanced work in integrating climate science and decision making, you know, that was led by a guy named Sam Higuchi, who recently retired, who spent more than 20 years leading interagency groups coming together, utilizing advanced NASA data analytics and climate risk management to basically develop a new field associated with climate risk management. Sam Higuchi is actually one of the great sort of unsung heroes of the United States in many ways. And his work and that of many people are resonated in all of these plans.
Jesse, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Jesse Keenan, Associate Professor of Real Estate in the School of Architecture at Tulane University. He talked about government agencies' climate change adaptation plans just out last week. Coming up after the news, the author of a new book says big cities were designed to segregate people based on race. We'll look at the impact that continues to have to this day. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, it can be a tough conversation, but an important one. Find out how to give teens the right message about underage drinking. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, Midwestern cities like Detroit, Chicago, and Milwaukee are among the most racially segregated urban areas in the country. And they're just a few of the many cities with high rates of segregation. Our next guest says that didn't happen by accident. Instead, it was the result of decades of intentional decision-making. She writes that as a result of cities being designed to limit African-Americans to certain areas, geography itself has become a major dividing line in society, and that it's time to abolish and repair the unequal system it's created. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the history of major cities and how they were designed and racially segregated? Has this been an issue in your own life, in your own community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Cheryl Cashin is a professor of law, civil rights, and social justice at Georgetown University. She's the author of the new book, White Space, Black Hood, Opportunity Hoarding and Segregation in the Age of Inequality. Cheryl, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
We think of division and disparities by income level, by race. What led you to focus on geography, the space of our communities?
Well, I have spent 25 years of my academic life studying residential segregation. I also worked in the Clinton White House on community development. And this book is the result of these decades of writing and thinking about this. And I also, frankly, I have an undergraduate degree in electrical engineering, and I'm a self-taught historian. I took a systems analysis to this. It took me a long time to figure it out, but there's no other way to understand the persistence of racial and economic inequality in this country without understanding the central role of geography. And I say we have a system of residential caste where government overinvests and excludes in high opportunity areas and disinvests and contains people and frankly preys on them in high poverty neighborhoods, particularly high poverty Black neighborhoods. And we have a mythology often used in politics that tells stories about the people in the hood to justify the way things are. And the biggest myth of all is that high income living is earned, I mean, high opportunity living is earned, and hood living is the deserved result of pathological behavior. When in fact, favored places, high opportunity favored places are subsidized by the overwhelming majority of people who are excluded from those places. Through their income, gas taxes, other taxes, people of all colors and classes who live elsewhere help pay for the roads, sewers, and golden infrastructure in these low poverty, resource rich places. And, you know, the thing you have to understand is the hostility to the 6 million Black great migrants who migrated north and west from the South in the first seven decades of the 20th century is what created residential caste. And you know, everybody's ensnared in it, but it's animated, it persists to this day, and it's animated by three anti-Black processes: boundary maintenance, opportunity hoarding, and stereotype-driven surveillance.
Growing up in the 70s and 80s, it seemed like segregation was just a part of the landscape. Maybe it had evolved naturally. It's just the way things were. Part of the story you tell is decision-making from the federal government down to a local neighborhood group that put this into place. Can you talk about this segregation that we see now as the result of that really conscious process of decisions?
Right. You know, in the first two-thirds of the 20th century, beginning in the 19-teens, going straight forward through the 70s, racially restrictive covenants, exclusionary zoning that limits where multifamily buildings can be built, urban renewal projects that pushed out Black residents, intentionally segregated public housing projects, an interstate highway program intentionally laid to create physical barriers between the Black and white sides of towns, and then endemic redlining, you know, marking Black neighborhoods from the 30s as not worthy of government-backed or government-insured mortgages, as well as just disinvestment in basic services in Black neighborhoods, in schools, roads, sewers, such that the distressed conditions in Black neighborhoods tended to be began to be associated with the Black people who lived there. You know, that's the history. But I fast forward to today. The federal government continues to invest in segregation. It subsidizes the construction of affordable housing, about $10 billion a year through its low-income housing tax credit program. That subsidy is built mostly, you know, those units are built mostly in poor communities that already have their fair share of affordable housing, right? Only a fraction of affordable housing gets built in high opportunity neighborhoods with high performing schools and easy access to jobs. I could go on, you know. Our former president, Donald Trump, when he was campaigning in 2020, bragged in the summer of 2020 about rescinding a regulation that was designed to implement the Fair Housing Act of 68 the requirement, the legal requirement, that all localities that receive federal funds must affirmatively further fair housing. And he tweeted about, you know, congratulations, you know, I've saved your, you know, beautiful suburb from low income housing. Thank me, right? So, you know, the overt policy of the Trump administration was to promote segregation. But, you know, we still have very little accountability from the federal government for the spending it does in enforcing the idea embodied in the Fair Housing Act that all communities are supposed to be promoting open housing. And there's still a lot of on the ground resistance to it.
We're talking to Cheryl Cashin about her new book, White Space, Black Hood, Opportunity Hoarding, and Segregation in the Age of Inequality. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Do you see segregation in your community? Here in Wisconsin, we have some of the most segregated cities in the country by many standards. What do you think? Call 800-642-1234. Cheryl, you mentioned opportunity hoarding as one of the three processes that keep segregation and its impacts alive. Can you talk about what it is, first of all?
Well, it's the fact that wealthy neighborhoods enjoy the best public services, environmental quality, private and public and natural amenities, while all other communities are left with fewer, poorer quality resources. That doesn't happen naturally. It's because elites tend to bend public policies to their will, and they tend to get more than their fair share of beautiful in infrastructure, you know, and beautiful amenities. And we tend to disinvest elsewhere. I don't have specific data for Milwaukee, but I do for Chicago. And for example, a 2019 study found that in Chicago, which is also very segregated, public and private investment get white neighborhoods received three times the public and private investment that majority black neighborhoods do. In Baltimore, which frankly has had something like seven or more black mayors and has a majority black representation on its city council, they did a study of where their community development dollars were going, and they, to their own horror, they found that they were spending four times as much money in white neighborhoods than majority black ones. And this is, you know, a consistent practice. So that's opportunity hoarding. And again, the people excluded from high opportunity areas are subsidizing all of that beautiful infrastructure.
We're talking to Cheryl Cashin, professor of law at Georgetown, author of the new book, White Space, Black Hood, Opportunity Hoarding and Segregation in the Age of Inequality. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the history of cities ending up segregated along racial and economic lines and the impact that's had? Do you notice a divide in your community or where you're from between the wealthy area and everyone else? Are there solutions you think need to be put into place? We'll get into that in just a few minutes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Cheryl Cashin, author of the book White Space, Black Hood, looking at how cities created wealthy and poor neighborhoods largely along racial lines, the impacts that has, and some possible solutions. And Cheryl, I want to get into that now. We've touched on some of the history and the problems this segregation has created. I want to spend a chunk of time, though, on some of your suggested answers to it. And you have kind of two categories, rescue and abolition. And I want to start, repair and abolition. And I want to start with repair. What do you mean when you talk about repairing these neighborhoods we're talking about?
Well, let me say first that the beauty of understanding the systems of residential caste and the practices is that once you understand it, the way forward becomes rather obvious. You just need to dismantle those anti-Black practices. So you were interested in repair or abolition? I can't remember which one.
I want to do both. Let's start. Well, you were leaning toward abolition there. Let's go for it. What would that look like, reversing some of these practices that put us where we are today?
Okay, so investment and greenlining of historically defunded Black neighborhoods rather than disinvestment and economic predation. All of the Black neighborhoods that were marked with a D, marked as hazardous with the redlining maps of the 1930s, that's the Federal Housing Administration. Most Black neighborhoods where great migrants landed were marked as D, and I read the history in Milwaukee and that all of the Black neighborhoods in Milwaukee, and they included a lot of Russian Jews were in some of those neighborhoods too, but they were marked as D, and immediately, even in vital Black neighborhoods, disinvestment and decline starts. And the Fed recently issued a study which found that 8 decades later, those very same neighborhoods experience disinvestment, decline, segregation, distress that can't correlate with that original D. So they should receive priority if any new infrastructure money is forthcoming, or if any, you know, with community development funds.
Who would
right?
Be,
the second. I'm sorry,
I just
ahead.
Wanted to ask, who would need to take the lead on that? Is this something that would have to come from Congress and the White House? Could it be neighborhood by neighborhood? Where would that come from?
I actually raise up the example of an organization in Milwaukee called Liberate MKE, which went through a citizen budgeting process among Black citizens of Milwaukee, where they identified their priority investments, which was, you know, nothing unusual, violence prevention, not tied to excessive policing, affordable housing and jobs for youth. And they proposed that some money be reallocated from policing to their priorities. And, you know, they were shocked when they found out that the city of Milwaukee was spending almost half of its budget on policing, right? I'm not arguing that that policing should be defunded or abolished, but you could, a number of cities have looked at their own budgeting processes, gone through a neighborhood equity analysis, and decided to give priority to neighborhoods that have historically been underfunded, right? So it could be that you create a strong, progressive, frankly, multiracial movement for equity in budgeting on the ground. And you don't have to wait for the federal government to come in as some kind of savior, right? There are cities that are doing that. Minneapolis, Seattle, Baltimore, they all now have a requirement of racial equity analysis. Joe Biden, within hours of being inaugurated, issued an executive order ordering analysis about racial equity across federal budgeting and put the formidable Ambassador Susan Rice in charge of it. So that's one area, you know, that's the opposite of opportunity hoarding. Another, you know, a big boundaries are, you know, both residential boundaries and school boundaries are a huge contributor to segregation. So ideally, every city should have a mandatory inclusionary zoning ordinance rather than an exclusionary one. And I hold up the example of Minneapolis, which repealed its single family zoning ordinance. Every neighborhood in that city now has to be open to more denser development. You know, California has repealed it in the sense that all neighborhoods now have to be able to receive duplexes. It's a baby step. But these are examples of, I guess you could say, both abolition and repair, disruption of, you know, of long-held processes that are fundamental to residential caste.
Before I run out of time, I do want to get into one example of repair that you give in the book. This one from California, a community that had a very targeted effort aimed at, in this case, it was violence prevention. Can you tell us about that? Because it was a story that I don't think I'd heard before.
Richmond, California had one of the highest homicide rates, gun violence rates in the country, higher than Chicago. And they were so desperate to try something different, they took an innovative idea from a guy named Devone Boggan, who had been not involved in violence prevention, but youth development, right? And he figured out, the police knew who was pulling the trigger. It was about two dozen young men. And what he figured out, he saw them with a lens of love. He saw himself in them. And he said, why don't we create a peacemaker fellowship, an 18-month fellowship, go to these guys, offer them a chance at something different. And the fellowship gave them a 24/7 mentor, a life map where they basically said, what do you need to have a different life? Do you need a GED, a driver's license, a job, cognitive behavioral therapy, drug treatment? Do you need to just get out of here, you know, travel, right? And to a person, almost every young man who was offered this deal took it. And the theory was that the people pulling the trigger or likely to are potentially the most transformative change agents, right? So he saw them as assets. And in fact, he got a foundation to give them, if they met their life plan, a 9-month stipend, $1,000 a month. Gun violence fell by 55%, right? And for an initial appropriation of $600,000 from Richmond matched with philanthropy, which is a heck of a lot cheaper than what Chicago spends about $1 million per inner city block in that city to incarcerate people, right? So my final point, and this is abolition and repair, transformation, is once you change the lens from presumed thug to presumed citizen and see people as potential assets in their own transformation, it frees you up to focus on evidence-based strategies that actually may be more effective and cheaper than just trying to contain and incarcerate people that you have you fear.
In just our last half a minute or so, do you see mm-hmm. that mindset changing in that direction you were just talking about?
I think in progressive cities, we see it happening, right? We had 20 million people protest last summer. Yes, I know that there was, riots and a lot of problems in Kenosha in Wisconsin, but we had 2,500 peaceful protests across this country with people raising signs saying Black Lives Matter. It's died down, but I still see the signs everywhere. And I think in cities, particularly that draw people who are open to difference, it is possible now to get a majority to support more innovative strategies that heal rather than damage, that include rather than exclude.
We'll leave it there. Cheryl, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
That's Cheryl Cashin, professor of law, civil rights, and social justice at Georgetown University. We've been talking about her latest book. It's called White Space, Black Hood: Opportunity Hoarding and Segregation in the Age of Inequality. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it's our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics, including a campaign for a key off-year election in Virginia. A lot of people have their eyes on it. Get a new installment of the WPR podcast, Mapped Out, with a look at the impact of political maps drawn 10 years ago and why they still shape Wisconsin politics today. And the U.S. Supreme Court often deals with controversial political issues, and lately the public is getting skeptical about the politics behind those decisions, at least according to some recent polls. We'll check out the Court of Public Opinion about the court. That's tomorrow on Central Time. It's fall, and that means lots of unusual flavor combinations out there related to the season. A lot of them feature pumpkin spice. As I mentioned a while back, pumpkin spice lattes showed up even earlier than usual this year at various coffee chains. A Madison grocery took things in a new direction, and it's gotten attention around the Wisconsin media world and beyond. It's a brat. Okay, nothing too weird there so far. Made with Oktoberfest beer. Okay, still on track. But also, in honor of the upcoming Halloween season, the brat has candy corn. The meat manager at Jennifer Street Market tells the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, you really only notice it when you bite into the candy corn, but it's not overbearing. It pairs well together. Yeah, he goes on, it's something I wouldn't eat with ketchup and mustard, but maybe with pretzels and eat it hors d'oeuvre style. Apparently, these Spooktoberfest brats are selling about as fast as they can make them. They plan to continue until they run out of the Oktoberfest beer they're using. They do have a reliable supply of brats and candy corn, though. I have enjoyed brats with some sweet elements in them, like apple, for example. Candy corn might be taking a little too far for me. But favorite Halloween candies, maybe some peanut butter cup brats? Is that an idea whose time has come? Probably not. I'd try it, though, once. Brat news you can use. This is Central Time.